Well, hello everybody out there in Turdland. Once again, this is your humble correspondent, Turd, coming at you with another in the installment series of TFMR podcasts. Today, we have, I think, a real treat for you. Someone who was instrumental in, I guess, my eyes opening to the world of precious metals several years ago. It is the one and only Dan Norsini. Dan, as many of you know, has been associated with Jim Sinclair's JS Mindset for years, but he also runs his own Blogspot site, which you'll see is linked conveniently into the text of this podcast. Dan has been an independent trader for more years than I'm sure he'd like to admit, but he still has, as far as I can tell, a pretty good head of hair, so that's good, though it might not have its original color. But anyway, Dan has graciously offered to share some time and some insight with us. So without further ado, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Turd. It's great to be with my pal. I've been following your website for a long time now since you've got it started up, and it's always a fun read for me. And it's great to be here and have a chance to chat with you and chat and have the listeners sit in and hear our conversation.
Dan, it's a real treat. And I guess for the audience out there, let's start with a little bit about your background. You've been a trader by living for quite some time now. Can you kind of give us just a brief synopsis of your career and what got you to where we are today?
Yeah, I sure can. I mean, I've been in this business for, as you said in the introduction, probably for more years than I care to remember at this point. I think I got started back in the late 1980s. More or less started right into the commodity complex. I never did do much with equities, Turd. I just never had an inclination for whatever reason. I was just attracted to the commodity sector. Maybe just because of my other background just made me feel comfortable with the supply and demand issues with, you know, whether it's a grain or the livestock or what have you. And so I just gravitated toward those naturally. And like any other trader, I probably learned most of my technique, my style, whatever, just through learning what not to do. In other words, when you get into this business, there are a lot of books out there about, you know, how to trade, how to do this, how to do that. But I found out in personal experience that it's a lot easier to read those books than it is to actually get out there in the real world and actually start trading for a living. You know, one of the things I learned very early on was that leverage can either make you or break you. And in order to be successful as a trader, you have to learn a lesson very early in your trading career to respect leverage, particularly the power it has to hurt you. It can do it very, very quickly. I mean, a lot of guys come into this business with, you know, dollar signs flashing in their eyes, and you know, they've already got the yacht picked out they're going to buy. They've already got a name emblazoned on the side of it, September Wheat. You know, they look at they approach a market and they go, how much money am I going to make in this market when I put this trade on? And really, I mean, I was like that when I first started. Of course, you're enthusiastic, you're excited, you know, you think you can make some pretty good money in this, but what you don't understand is how quickly losses can come, particularly if you're on the wrong side of the market and you don't know you're on the wrong side of the market. And then those losses can compound so quickly they can take your account down and clean you out. And there's an awful lot of casualties, you know, in the commodity trading business. And, you know, I think, I'm not sure what the latest statistics are, Turd, but I think probably about 95% of the people who go in and trade in the commodity complex end up losing money ultimately. You know, they some will make it, but then they'll lose it and give it all back. And that really comes down to, again, a lack of respect for the power of leverage. And it also comes back to not really understanding sound money management principles. And again, those are things that I learned mainly through the School of Hard Knocks. And, you know, I've told people that I paid dearly for my education in the commodity complex. And what I mean by that is when I first started, I lost an awful lot of money. But one good thing comes out of that. If you're willing to learn from your mistakes, those mistakes can actually be more valuable to you than the actual winners, because they'll teach you how to keep what you've earned, which is something I think is very important for traders to know.
And yeah, about that today, as that relates to the metals markets, and that with the way those markets are, at least in my humble opinion, controlled and dominated by these manipulative short positions that are built and then covered at traders' expense, it's almost like it's a big shell game sometimes, and that you approach the shell game on the corner and they say, hey, oh yeah, this is easy. And they show you, they pick up the shell and they show you and they roll them around and maybe they let you win once or twice so you get your confidence and then you plunge because now you got to figure it out and then they pull the rug out from under you. And same.
Oh man, that, you know, Turd, that is so true. You know, what will happen to a trader? I mean, a lot of trading is mental. I mean, and what I mean by that is you really have to master your emotions. I know that may sound sort of like, oh, well, there's nothing secret about that. But I tell you, it's a lot harder to do it in practice than it is in theory, because there's a tendency in all of us when we feel that we're on the right side of a trade. In other words, we've looked at a market, and let's just take the gold and the silver markets, the precious metals. You know, we've looked at the fundamentals behind this bull market that's been going on for more than a decade now. You know, we know the reasons why we want to own the metals. I mean, we know about the U.S. budget deficits. We know about the money printing. We know about the liquidity. You know, we know all about those sort of things, that, you know, the debt and sovereign debt issues, all the things that have come down the pike over the last decade. And so we say, all right, I'm going to put a long position on in gold or a long position on in silver. And we go in there and we feel pretty confident. And as you said, you know, the market maybe will start going our way. And then all of a sudden, bam, it gets hit. Down it goes. You know, the speculative flush begins and the market starts selling off. Well, what often happens in many traders is that they stubbornly refuse to get out.
Yeah.
They'll say, all right, you know, I'm losing a little bit of money, but I know it's going to come back. I know it's going to come back. I know it's going to come back. And they keep telling themselves that, and all the while the market continues to drop and move against them. And, you know, it goes further down. They go, oh, I know it's going to come back. Or in many cases, they rush in there and they go, I'm going to buy some more. I'm going to buy some more. And what happens is they end up trying to catch a falling knife, and their accounts literally are too small. They're undercapitalized to try to trade like that. And next thing you know, they literally have no money left because they've been forced out of the position by the margin clerks. And that's the end of their trading career. And what you have to learn in this industry, particularly when you are dealing with a market that's managed by the official sector, is you have to be able to say, okay, look, I have a fundamental view that tells me I need to be on the long side of gold. But if these guys are determined to take this thing down, I'm going to step aside. And I'm going to let them do their game, and I'm going to wait for signs of a bottom, and then I'll come back in on the long side of the market. You know, you can't sit there and fight against them. You're too small. And I remember very early in my career thinking, okay, I could put a 5-lot or a 10-lot order into a market, and boy, I was going to turn that market around single-handedly. And that just comes back from being naive and not really understanding the size and the scope of the people you're trading against. And the best thing to do, if it looks like a position is going against you, Turd, just get out of the way. You know, the market will be there tomorrow. It'll be there the day after. You can always get back into a market. But that assumes that you've got some money left to play with. So don't let a small loss, don't let that grow into a large one. That's the most important lesson I've learned as a trader. Take your licks. If you have a loss, that's okay. That's part of the game. You're not going to be 100% right all the time. Get out of the way and then wait for the market to show some signs of stabilizing in the direction that you think it ought to be going, and then you can step back in. What that does is it allows you to buy at a lower level with a little bit less downside risk. And you're not, in other words, you're still trying to buy low. You're not buying high and chasing it higher. But at the same token, you're buying smart. You're not just going in there and buying blindly because the market's going down. So in other words, let the technicals tell you when it's time to get back in. But don't fight the technicals. If it looks like the market wants to go lower and you're long, step aside. Yeah. Just get out of the way for the time being.
Yeah, that's outstanding advice. And what's so hard to do, especially in the metals, is I think we're all emotionally and to some extent politically invested in them.
Yeah.
And so you know, the math is the math. You know that you're going to be right in the end. But to step aside, boy, you got to really kind of swallow your pride to some extent. But it's all you can do sometimes.
It is, Turd. It's very hard to do. I mean, like I said, it's much easier to do in theory than it is in actual practice. But it's what you need to do in order to survive in this business if you're going to be a trader. Now, remember, you know, a trader and an investor are two different mindsets. You know, an investor is more of a long-term oriented person. A trader, depending on your perspective, I mean, my goodness, you have traders that are trading off a 3-minute bar chart. Some of them are trading off 15-minute charts. Some are an hour. You know, a long-term trade for some of those guys is 20 minutes. So, you know, everything depends on your perspective when you approach a particular market. And as you said, though, you know, when you get emotionally attached to a trade, that's the big thing. I use the expression, never get married to a trade. You have to approach it very businesslike, very sort of bland, you almost indifferent if you can. You look at it as a money-making opportunity or as a potential to lose money. You say, all right, if I put a trade on here, where do I recognize that I'm wrong? Where has the trade gone wrong? And you do that before you stick the trade on. So in other words, don't ever blindly move into a market without some sort of plan in your mind as to when the market is going to confirm your ideas. In other words, if you're going to go into a market and you're going to take a long position, and you do take the position, let's say, what you want to see at that point is you want to see the market confirm your trade. In other words, you want to see that thing continue to move up, and that gives you the confidence saying, okay, I put the trade on, this is a good spot. Even while it's moving up, however, you need to constantly look at that trade and say, all right, when is a sign or an indicator that this thing may begin to turn on me? And at what point do I want to take and get out of the trade, or at least lighten up the position? And those are things that you do generally prior to putting the trade on, so you can recognize when you're right or when you're wrong. The quicker that you recognize that your trade is wrong, the quicker you can get out and the less money you'll lose. And basically, if you won't lose, if you don't allow yourself to take those big losses, you can stand a small loss, because generally, if you're doing this right, the winners that you're gonna have will outnumber the losers, and that's what you're after in this business if you want to survive.
You know, Dan, I know you like my metaphors, my turdistic metaphors, and you just gave me another one. You know, if you marry a woman emotionally, at least at the end, all she can do is take half. But if you get married to a trade, man, that trade can take everything from you.
Yeah, that trade's got one hell of an attorney. That's for sure. That's exactly right. Yeah, I like that, Dirk. You always do come up with these great little euphemisms, little quips. But yeah, and that's the deal. I mean, again, it's hard to do it when you've got real money on the line. I mean, I've talked to guys, and I used to do it myself when I first started. You do the paper trade routine. You get the book, or you buy the program, or whatever it is. You buy the system, and they say, all right, let's put some paper trades on. And when you got a paper trade on and the market's moving against you, okay, I lost 2%, I lost 5%, I lost 10%, it's no big deal, it's just paper. It gives you the wrong mindset when you come out with real money. I mean, when you got real money on the line, money that you sweated to earn, or you've worked hard, you've done without, and you finally got that trading capital together and you put it into an account and you put it on and you start trading and that market moves against you, man, I mean, it is a totally different experience, because you realize this is real money, and it may not come back. You know, I remember the very first trade I ever put on in my life. It was an October sugar. I never will forget it. And the very first day I put the trade on an October sugar, I immediately lost a full point, $1,120. That was my introduction to trading, and go, my goodness, I had no idea you could lose money so quickly in these markets. So, but you know what? It was a good experience, because it taught me just how dangerous these things are. And again, if you've got respect for the leverage, how it can hurt you, I think you'll be okay. You just can't get careless. You can't get reckless. That's what happens to a lot of traders. As a matter of fact, it happens even to experienced traders. They get to the point where, the market, they've had a bunch of winners, the market's been good to them, and they sort of get careless. They don't really monitor positions maybe as closely as they did under other circumstances or whatever. They get sloppy, and then they make the same kind of mistakes they made when they were a rookie, and they end up getting hurt as a result, and then they have to really, get back to basics, and sometimes, go down to trading a lot smaller in size just to sort of kind of get their routine back and remember what made them successful and go back to doing that.
That's right. They start thinking as if they're playing with house money. And first of all, it's not house money. It's your money now. And additionally, why should that change the rules? Why should that change your discipline? You're absolutely right. Tell me, Dan, in that environment then, how do you feel about options, whether it's options on futures or just options in general? Is that something that you use? Is that something you advise people use?
Well, I can give you my personal view of it. Personally, Turd, I'm not a big fan of options. And not that I'm against them, but just in my style of trading, the markets I trade, the way I trade, I don't really use them, but I'm not against them. But here's the reason that I don't particularly use them. For me, the biggest challenge as a trader is really trying to get a sense of, all right, which way do I think this market is going to go? Is it going to go higher? Is it going to go lower? I mean, obviously what you're trying to do as a trader, you're trying to discern a trend in the market, whether the market is trending higher or lower, whether it's in a sideways pattern, whatever. Many times, particularly when you're in a really volatile environment like you are right now in so many of these markets, it's confusing because the extent of price moves that you're seeing. I mean, you get huge down days followed by big up days, and it's very confusing as far as trying to get a feel for what direction the market wants to go. So, number one, that's challenging enough. But if you're going to do options, generally, if you're going to buy them, let's say, not if you're going to write them, but if you're going to buy an option or go long an option, to use that expression, not only do you have to get the trend correct, you have to get the timing on it correct, yes, too, because you have a time premium in an option that decays on you. I mean, you can be, and I let me back up and say it this way. Early in my career, Turd, I did use options, and I was generally long. I didn't sell too many options or write them. And I would find, through my own experience, that I would be right on the direction. I mean, I got the direction down, but what happened was the market took too long before it actually started trending in that direction, and the time premium in the option that I bought had decayed so quickly that I ended up losing money, even though I was right. And so I kind of shied away from them, but I do think there is a place for them, particularly in the metals, for guys who, you know, kind of trade more or less exclusively in the silver or gold market, is that you can use these options when you look at, for instance, like the commitment of traders reports, and you see some of these extreme buildups on the commercial side, on the short end of the market, versus an extreme buildup on the long side in the hedge fund or the speculative side of the market. If these things are getting into the very, very high levels of, you know, net long, net short, to the point where they're kind of reaching up to historical norms where peaks have happened in the market, that's a good time for guys who want some downside protection to look at some put options, because generally you want to buy put options when the market's going up, because that's when your premium on them is going to be lower and you're going to get them at a better price. You don't want to buy a put option normally after the market drops $100 like we did, was it a week ago, 2 weeks ago in gold, because then all the option writers, obviously you're going to charge you an arm and a leg if you're going to buy, if, you know, if they're going to sell you a put, they're going to want you to pay up for it. But if the market is rallying and it looks perhaps like it's stalling at a significant chart level and you like the option route, well, then you can pick up some put options. That'll give you a little bit more confidence to sit there, hold your position if you're not quite sure, because you have at least some downside on that, downside protection if you have the put option. You can always buy it and cover it, you know, close the position out and take a long off at the same time and, you know, feel pretty good that you've locked in the profit doing it that way. So that's a use that I see for them. I see guys, you know, can also do spreads and options. Again, it's not my particular style. One of the reasons, Turd, was because of liquidity in some of the markets I was trading. It just is not there in the option pit. You have to pay up if you want to get some out of the money options that are kind of distant out there. The premiums on them are so expensive, it's just prohibitive. Yeah. At least that's just my view, but other guys love them.
Well, no, and that's very good advice. And I want to kind of spin that off into one more kind of, and it's not necessarily a trading question, but something that I think we can draw from your experience. I didn't warn you that I was going to ask you this question. So if this isn't something that you really know, just say, turn that time. I don't know. One thing that I'm very concerned about, concern's the right word. As we head into the spring, and I ask you this as being a veteran trader, not just of the metals, because I know your bailiwick is a lot of grains and cattle, right, Dan? And that more, okay.
Right. Exactly.
What do you think the impact of MF Global, the long-term impact, is and will be? I mean, one, in the metals, you know, we're hearing about compliance departments that are not allowing firms to trade there anymore, that maybe it's not really a accepted the delivery platform for the metal, not that it really ever was, you know, to a great extent, but are you concerned, you see, are you worried at all about, you know, the farmers, the ranchers, the co-ops being reluctant to trade into a futures platform post MF Global?
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate point to raise, Turd. I mean, you know, what MF did was just in our industry that we're in is, that's the closest thing I can think of to use a description of doing something that's blasphemous, for lack of a better word. what they did was so outlandish, was so despicable that it, you know, it just is something that just never ever was heard of in the commodity complex. You know, customer money was sacred. I mean, it's just a sacred thing. You didn't touch it, and it was always segregated. And that was basically done so that the clearing members had confidence among their customers. I mean, in other words, if a customer, just like you said, is worried about the viability of that the firm, whether or not they're going to mingle monies there, well, of course, I mean, that casts a dark cloud over the entire industry. And I know that, you know, several clearing firms immediately after MF had its debacle, you know, sent emails out and letters out by mail to their clients stating that, you know, we do not do what MF Global does, you know. And these are some of the guys that I looked at. Matter of fact, you know, my brokers that I use, the firms that I use, both of them along that way. And the reason that they are is because, you know, they're from the old school. They, you know, they were started by guys who, you know, actually had some ethics to them, had some moral principles. They didn't do that sort of thing, and then that's the way the firm operates. So one of the things I could tell people is that a lot of it depends on the firm that you're using. I mean, Farmers and Ranchers, as you said, I have a special affinity for those guys because I know how they struggle at times. I know what they struggled in the past and all the issues they deal with. The last thing they need to deal with is when they're putting hedges on for their production, have to worry about the viability of the firm. I mean, that's just one thing they don't need to worry about, and they shouldn't have to worry about it. I mean, the industry should be taking care of that. But having said that, when you look at a firm, stay with a firm whose business is strictly that, commodities. You know, don't mess with these other guys that are trying to have their own prop desk or their own, you know, do other things as well. Stay with guys that deal with commodities, particularly that have a track record that goes back a long way. You're not a Johnny-come-lately firm. And talk to them when you open the account up. Say, hey, you know, this is my concern. What do you have? What's the philosophy of your firm? I mean, how do you treat customer money? Do you do trades for your own benefit? If so, et cetera, explain that to me. You know, don't be afraid to question these guys. After all, you're the customer. You don't have to take your business there. You can go somewhere else. And if these guys want to keep their customers, then they're going to have to make sure that they take steps to make sure that they have the confidence in that firm. I mean, that's how I look at this thing, Turd. I think that the MF Global was sort of a wake-up call to the industry. I'm hoping that it's not symptomatic of the industry at large. At least some of the clearing firms that have been around a lot longer, it's not. Those guys, like I said, they vociferously objected to what MF Global did, made their feelings very clear. But like you said, once you let that genie out of the bottle, then it does cast some suspicion on the industry as a whole. That's why guys have to be much more careful with the firms that they're going to use and open accounts with.
No, that's very good advice. Dan, you've been extremely generous with your time, and I know everyone is very much learning a lot, appreciating your point of view. I did just ask you just a couple more quick questions, because I'm sure folks out there are wondering where you see things going. I mean, you detail things on your website very well, and I think most folks that are familiar with you are pretty familiar with your ideas about the market and this country and the debt level and everything else. What do you have, like, your own personal forecast? What are some things we should be watching for as the year goes along here? And I mean, are you anticipating overt quantitative easing anytime soon? What's on your radar at this point, Dan?
Well, the way I see it, Turd, right now, I mean, and I think, you know, pretty much in the gold community, we're all on the same consensus that the reason that we're seeing the equity markets where they are right now is really because of liquidity injections being put in place by the Western central banks, whether it's the ECB, whether it's the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the Fed. You know, just pick the bank. They're all pretty much practicing some form of either QE or zero or near zero monetary, you know, interest rate policy for monetary policy. Not only that, you have a huge amounts of debt being racked up by these, you know, Western governments and Western economies. You know, down in the long haul, I think this is the thing is, you know, long haul, all of us are bullish gold and silver, and I think we ought to be, simply for the fact that we're looking at the fundamentals, we're looking at the huge amount of indebtedness. And you know, here's the deal, Turd, in my opinion, we have so much debt in the United States at this point, yet the mathematics are now, in my mind, prohibitive against this thing ever being paid down. I personally just don't see how you could ever get the country to grow at a fast enough clip that you could literally reduce the indebtedness or at least pay off. I mean, that's never going to happen. Even if you got growth rates to the rate of China, let's say we were in the U.S. to a growth rate of 8%. I mean, how in the world would that even be possible? I just we'll be doing good if we get to 3%, and I think if we got to 4%, people would be doing cartwheels in the aisle. So I don't see long term. I don't see how the U.S. debt is ever going to get paid off. And what that tells me is that ultimately, at some point, and I don't know exactly when it's going to occur. I think if we all did, we could all buy our own private island in the South Pacific and name it after ourselves. But the point is, eventually the dollar is going to have to be devalued. That's the only way they're going to be able to pay this debt back. They'll have to pay it back in dollars that are valued less than where they are today. Long term, that bodes very, very well for gold and silver. And again, the fundamental factors that have led to the rise in gold and silver prices have not really changed. What we're dealing with right now, as you and I are talking, Turd, is we're seeing, we saw a downdraft in gold, we saw a downdraft in silver, but this is more of a short term aberration. I mean, we've seen a lot of these things, these sell-offs like this going on, since 2001. So again, this is nothing new to witness this. And each time the metals, sell off, the same guys come out of the closet, predicting the demise of the bull market. But here's the deal. Has the fundamentals that have led to the rise of gold and silver and to the weakness in the dollar, have they really abated? Well, temporarily they've been papered over. But the structural problems, the huge sums of indebtedness, which is really to me the big issue here, the amount of debt in the system, have never really been addressed. They've just been papered over. So as long as those things are in operation, as long as the central banks basically are printing money or are having near zero interest rate policies in place, you're in an environment that's conducive to the metals rise in the long term. So that's why when these sell-offs occur, I know they're disconcerting for people out there in the precious metals community. Of course, we all like to see the metals go straight up without stopping, but generally when they do that, then they have violent sell-offs. These occasional sell-offs, these retracements in price are actually healthy. And the reason they are is because the big thing about the gold market in particular is every time you get a drive to a new high, whether it's a new lifetime high, whether we hit 1,000, whether we hit 1,200, 14, 16, eventually 19, it's always the same thing. There's always a little bit of sticker shock among the end users simply when they go to buy that and they look at the price and their heart starts skipping a beat over there. And so what happens is this market moves lower, and then it consolidates for a while. It goes sideways, whatever. But what that basically does is it acclimatizes people to this new and higher price level. I liken the turds to kind of like on a cold day. It's 0 degrees. You're in a warm house at 70. You step outside, and man, the initial shock is like, holy moly, man, and it just slaps you in the face. But once you spend some time out there and you're moving around, eventually you get used to it. You're acclimatized to it. It doesn't bother you as much. It's the same thing with these markets. The end users, the big buyers of the physical metal, need time to get acclimated to these higher prices. And so when you get these periodic retracements in the price of the metals, that's exactly what it allows them. It allows them to kind of get used to paying a higher price. But the higher price is being paid at a higher level. That's the thing. Go back and look at where gold was a year ago. Go back and look at where gold was 2 years ago. And you can see, it's been a steady climb. And so I don't particularly worry too much about it, although, like I said, I sometimes wish the sell-offs weren't quite so dramatic because they shake a lot of guys out of the market as far as our longer-term holdings go, and they get rattled, and then they're wondering if they ought to even be in precious metals, where I think they're making a mistake. But anyhow, going back to what you had asked me earlier, do I, longer term, my views on where we're going, unless I see some sort of total revamping of our monetary policy, our structural problems in our economy, Turd, I don't see anything changing that would cause me to change my views of where gold and silver are going ultimately. The U.S. has some serious problems. So does Western Europe. So does Japan. Japan's not only has a problem with their economy, although their economy is slightly improving, but they have a problem. Their demographics now are working against them over there, too. Their birth rate has fallen so low that they have a problem there. Those things all add up. And when you look at the growth rate in developing nations like India and China, and you look at the growth rate of the nations out in the West, you can see where economic power is going to be moving. I mean, it's going to gradually be moving from West to East. And then that's, the idea that the U.S. would remain the center of economic power, like it's some sort of birthright, is not true. I mean, we have to have good policy. We have to have good politicians. We have to have good, monetary and fiscal policy to maintain that. And if we don't, then we'll do like any other great nation or empire in history. We'll slide backward. And that's the thing that concerns me, not only as a trader, as an investor, but just as a citizen of the country. I mean, obviously, I want these problems taken care of, but we need to have the political will
exactly.
to do it.
And not much of that coming over the horizon at this point, that's for sure. And there's no reason to think that's going to change. I guess my last question for you, I intend to spend more time on this topic in the coming weeks and months, and so it just leads me to think I should just ask you while I got you on the line. There's this, if you were born, I guess, any time after about the time my dad was born in 1929, so his whole awareness at 82, Dad, I'm sorry, I'm using you as an example if you're listening.
Well, that's good. I was going to tell the listeners I was born in 1929,
and Dan,
too.
And Dan was in my dad's high school class. they've been friends for life. That's how I know him. And my
that's
mother
right,
would say,
yeah.
of course, that, you know, my dad married her when she was five. So that, but anybody that's my dad's age and younger, and there are not a lot of those people, you know, around and getting to be less and less, all they know is U.S. hegemony in world affairs, in military affairs, in economic affairs, everything. That's their only experience. And 99% of the people out there only can function and only operate within their own worldview, their own experience. They can't even begin that tomorrow will be different from yesterday. I see clearly, I mean, I just try to think of it, you know, if I were in charge, because of course I kind of have, I'm a little bit megalomaniacal, I think, as everyone knows, if I was in charge of a creditor nation of the U.S., I would be moving toward, knowing the math, what it is, I would be moving toward a day where I can take my currency and partially back it with hard assets to bring it to a status of the current reserve currency, if anything, and I'm specifically thinking about the Chinese because they have 1.2 billion people. Yeah. They will have an interest in, let's say, pacifying them in the same way that the American politicians pacified the American population for the last 40 years with free stuff. And if the Chinese become some type of regional or global reserve currency, they will have the luxury that the United States has had for the last 40 years of just freely printing money and exporting the inflation to other parts of the globe. So I see that coming. Anyway, I think I told you this platform is not for me to talk, so now here I am talking.
I like that, Turd. I agree with your assessment. I really do, and that's the point. I mean, we have not in our nation, we have not really, the generation I'm speaking, you know, generally here, but the current generation doesn't know anything besides having the U.S. dollar as the center, you know, the center of the global currency market. They just don't, they've never known anything else. And, you know, it's to me, you have to go back to think about the British pound. You know, the sun, what was the boast? The sun never sets on the British Empire. You know, Hail Britannia, Britannia yep. rules the seas. And, you know, anywhere you went around the globe, there was a colony of Britain somewhere. And, of course, the British pound was the global reserve currency. And, you know, the idea was somebody would have said to you back in the, you know, let's say 1900, 1901, 1902, that the pound would be displaced by this upstart country, you know, the America, and by the U.S. dollar, you know, somebody would have probably laughed at you at that time. But obviously it happened, you know, it did change. I mean, you had World War One left Great Britain with a tremendous amount of debt from which they never recovered, really. And then World War Two was like the final straw that broke the camel's back. And obviously, you know, when Bretton Woods basically set the dollar as a global reserve currency there, everything changed. And the idea was that, you know, all right, the British pound is no longer the center of the global currency universe. Well, the same conditions that led to the demise of the pound, as the global reserve currency, can now be seen in the history of the United States. I mean, the same sort of conditions, huge amount of indebtedness, loss of, you know, manufacturing, loss of the things that were essential to Britain's great buildup as a powerful empire, as a powerful nation, and the nation began to decline. Now, you know, as an American citizen, I don't like to talk about things like that. It's uncomfortable for me to even talk about it because I'm talking about the future that my children have to inherit. But the fact is, you know, the warning signs are there. The same sort of conditions are there. And the fact that you're getting so much noise from some of these developing countries, whether it's Brazil or China or, you know, Russia, whatever it is, more or less kind of frustrated that the dollar still remains at the center of the global currency universe, and it allows the U.S. to be so undisciplined in its monetary policy. There's a lot of resentment that these nations have, and rightfully so. And at some point, you will see a move, you know, further and further away from the dollar. Now, it may take 5 years, it may take 10 years, 15, 20 years. I don't know. I don't really know what the timetable is, but I think it's coming, and I really do. And I think at that time, you're going to have the same sort of feelings in the U.S. citizenry at large that the Great Britons, you know, the Brits must have experienced when their pound was no longer the center of the currency universe. So I think what we can just do is watch, monitor, see what's going on. Maybe hope that we get some guys in there who really understand these things and can institute some structural change in the nation. But either way, it's going to be very politically unpopular to do those sorts of things. So you wonder whether we're actually going to be able to address these problems and deal with them, or else we're just going to fade and kind of slowly go the way of Britain.
Well, on that happy note, Dan.
Yeah, well, I'm on the window ledge in my house right now, Turd, and I'm ready to jump. But that's one of the reasons my office is on the first floor here, because the thing that can happen to me is when I jump, I can just break the azalea bushes. That's,
you know,
all that happens.
That's good forward planning, Dan. That's risk.
That's why we're traders here, buddy. We always
think
ahead. That's right.
Oh, Dan, gosh, much for spending some time. I really appreciate it. I hope that we get an opportunity to visit again sometime soon, because you've got such a vast wealth of experience to share, but also you've obviously got it figured out as to where we're going and how to prepare for what lies ahead. So I encourage everybody to put Dan's Blogspot site onto their favorites list. Again, the link is right there in the text of this podcast. You want to check there. He's unable, because he's just so darn busy, to update it every day, but I'd stop there at least every day just in case he did. The information he puts on there is always valuable. And Dan, I want to thank you for spending some time here in Turd Land, and I hope we're able to visit again sometime soon.
Well, Turd, I have really, really enjoyed this. It's always a pleasure to visit Turd Land and see the various sites here in this wonderful land. So thanks for having me. I definitely look forward to doing this again. We'll do this in the future here, and hopefully all the listeners had a good time just listening to us chat amongst
next
amongst
time
a couple
we'll
of
both
good buddies.
Maybe have a beer while we're talking. How's that? That might be.
Now that could get really interesting. That would be lots of fun. There's no telling what would come out on that interview.
All right. Thank you, Dan. You have a good weekend.
Same to you, Turd. Take care now, buddy.